The Psalms just do that. They enable us to know that our pain is inhabited by God, and that waiting, you know, and being honest about where we are is part of the healing process. Sometimes we have to sit with the difficulty, but we never sit alone.
Welcome to Psalms for the Spirit, a podcast about spirituality and resilience through the lens of the biblical Psalms. I'm Kieran Young Wimberly, a Presbyterian minister and spiritual director from the US, but living on the north coast of Ireland. I've been working closely with the Psalms for about a decade now, arranging, recording, performing Psalms set to Celtic melodies, along with my dear friends, the McGrath family from Dungannon, County Tyrone. And through the years, I've heard how the Psalms help people through times of trouble, through times when the mountains seem to be falling into the sea, times when the world is in upheaval, either on a personal level or on a collective level. In this podcast, I'm inviting friends and respected teachers to explore with me how the Psalms lift our spirits in difficult times, how they lead us toward healing and hope, and about the connection between spirituality and resilience. Today's guest is John Bell, hymn writer, author, and broadcaster, a guiding light from the Iona community, as he has for decades created resources for the global church in music, worship, and spirituality. I first became aware of John Bell as I was growing up, when I started noticing his name in the credits for so many of the sacred songs that I loved. And then our paths crossed in Northern Ireland some years ago, when I was tasked with picking him up for a conference we were involved with. I have a striking memory of him striding out of the ferry in his bright red Doc Martin shoes, and I was delighted to discover that John Bell is warm and personable, has an easy laugh and a wry sense of humor, and speaks with a refreshing frankness while also displaying a clear empathy and compassion for others. I recently discovered that he had written a book entitled Living with the Psalms, so I got in touch to see if he would be willing to have a chat about his insights. And we were able to do so right when the world had its eye on his city of Glasgow during COP26. In this conversation, we talk about how the Psalms, much like the incarnation we celebrate in this season, speak of God's solidarity with us in our vulnerability. How the Psalms give us permission to express doubt and anger when we come face to face with suffering and injustice. How sacred songs have the power to heal and tend to the brokenhearted. And how the Psalms offer us the precious image of God as midwife, delivering us through the pains of life and death. Listeners, there is some sensitive content in this episode, so please be aware of that as you listen, and make sure you have the support you need in case any of the subjects are difficult to hear about. Most episodes of Psalms for the Spirit feature the music of Celtic Psalms, but it seemed only appropriate today to feature the renowned hymn writing of John Bell. Please see episode notes for information on the songs, and thanks to John, the Iona community, and GIA Music for allowing the use of these songs on this podcast. So whatever it is that brought you here, I'm glad you're with us. Where are you today? I know you've been traveling.
I'm in Glasgow. I'm in my home, and this is the first time I've had a week in my home for, well, since June.
Really? Oh, wow.
I'm not in my own bed. But I'm in my own house. The English government, Westminster government, wanted civil servants to work at short notice at the COP event and had no accommodation for them. So I've got a senior civil servant staying in my room, and I've got an activist in another room. And then there's a friend of the activist coming. So I think I'm going to be lying just underneath my desk.
By the end of it. So I begin all my conversations with the question, how is your spirit these days? So how would you answer that question?
Well, I'm tired, you know, because I've been in the move in the continent of Europe, and then I've spent about the last 2 months all around England. And when there was one time when I was in 8 different beds in 9 days. Okay. So I'm glad to be home, and I'm quite tired. And also, for the first time in 2 years, last night, a colleague and I led a vigil in the medieval cathedral here. Yeah. And I realised it's the first time that I've done anything of that kind of size and import for 2 years, mm-hmm. because all these things have been cancelled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm a little weary, but after last night, I feel quite positive.
How was that?
Yeah, it was good. It was a very good thing. We took people around the cathedral, north, south, east, west, at each point of the compass, remembering nations, and that sang songs from that part of the world, listened to voices from that part of the world. And then prayed. But to walk around, you know, and to make it a kind of event where you're recognising the sound of the world as well as the concerns of the world. Yeah. It was, I think people were really taken by it.
Well, how has COVID affected you over the past, you know, 2 years? It's nearly 2 years now. Being a singer and a leader of song, how was that experience for you to suddenly not only be forced into isolation, but to have that one, you know, really important aspect of what you do stripped away from you?
Yeah, pretty awful, actually. I mean, I'm gradually moving into kind of semi-retirement. So I expected that I would be beginning to take fewer engagements. But no, it was, not to be able to sing with other people. I mean, that's just an awful thing. You know, you go to church and all these psalms about praising the Lord, and you think, well, we can't do it. A, because we can't be together. And B, if we are together, we have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. So I found that, very debilitating. I mean, it's only when it's taken from you, you realise the significance and the value you've put on corporate worship. And just, you know, singing with other people, making a good sound to God with other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I didn't feel any happier than anybody else. I'm glad it's coming back now, but yeah, you know, it was hard.
I think we'll appreciate it all the more now. But yeah, for somebody like yourself who has spent so much of your life leading song with other people and focusing on music, and I'm sure some of what you do is private and you write your hymns and you do some of it on your own, but so much of it would have been singing with other people, and to have that, you know, taken away and inaccessible.
Yeah, and people have written and said, well, have you written anything? And I haven't, you know, not very much. Uh-huh. And well, there's two reasons. One is that just around 2 years ago, my colleague died, who was my kind of right hand. Mm-hmm. He was my other brain, so that's been hard. But also, I don't see COVID-19 as a destination that has to be celebrated. I see it as a process we've gone through. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we can fairly write about that experience until we've gone through it.
Yeah.
But what we can do is, to some extent, rely on the experience of others who have gone through similar things before us and use their spiritual resources, particularly the Psalms, to help us to get on. Mm-hmm. But I find it quite upsetting. Many people send me this, you know, thing, I've just written this song, it's all about, you know, COVID. I think, oh, come on, let us get through it and then reflect on it rather than be presumptuous.
We don't know what it's about yet.
I don't know what it's about, no. After 2 or 3 years, we'll be able to reflect on the context in which this has happened, and we might see it in a different light.
Yeah,
we're still on the journey.
Yeah, we sure are. So you've probably started singing a little bit more with people. Has that started up again?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Legally and illegally. Always at a safe distance.
So how did that feel? Do you remember the first time that you started singing again with other people?
Oh, yes, last Sunday. There's a group of us who have sung together before. We're not a choir, we just like singing, and we met in someone's house. And we all were, you know, doubly jabbed and all the rest of that, ventilated, whatever else you can do. Yeah. And people said, oh, this is so good. You know, we weren't singing anything new. We're just trying out some stuff and, you know, just enjoying it. And we could go down for hours. We ran out of material. Just, oh, this is great, this is so good.
You used to lead big sings, and there were like hundreds of people were there. Tell me about what that was like.
Yeah, we might have had about 2,000 people sitting in the grandstand of a racing track and teaching them to sing in four-part harmony.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Great.
That sound.
And I'm the only one who had anything like a qualification in music. You know that I'm particularly proud about it. But the rest were just for people who knew the bass of the tenor line. See, just all the guys on this side, follow me. But it was great. It was a great thing.
Hope that can happen again sometime soon.
Yeah.
Tell me about the Psalms. I know that you obviously have worked with the Psalms a lot. You've written some hymns based on the Psalms. You have written a beautiful book, Living with the Psalms, which I have now read and really appreciated. You have so many really poignant stories in there. And this book came out in March 2020, is that right?
Yeah.
So that's fascinating that it came out right when COVID was becoming a thing. Mm-hmm. And did you find that some of your insights from the book were applying to what was going on?
Yes, the nice thing was that it came out of a whole lot of workshops I was doing with people over maybe about 5 or 6 years on the Psalms. And so it certainly wasn't written for a pandemic. It's purely coincidental or by divine guidance that these things came together. What was surprising, I think, was for people who read it to discover that some of the insights in the book or the angles taken on the Psalms were now allowing them to enjoy certain psalms or to engage with certain psalms, which they never would in the past. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It took away, I think, or helped to take away the scare, because people were living through times in which they were experiencing, corporately or individually, emotions or frustrations which they'd never had before. Mm-hmm. And here was the possibility that these might actually be the things that you can offer to God. Mm-hmm. That's something which a number of people have mentioned.
Yeah, there were so many different psalms that you brought up that I could see, especially what I think of as, and maybe other people have referred to as, the more difficult psalms, because they are more difficult to engage with.
Well, I think, I mean, they're disturbing for Westerners. You know, people in the developing world who have to deal with political regimes that oppress them or adverse weather or whatever. I mean, they can deal with that language. It's we who believe that God is not happy unless we're offering a kind of tickling stick to heaven on a Sunday morning by praising endlessly. For us, it's difficult. And I think that we, particularly Protestants, have only sung selectively from the Psalms, read selectively. Most people in their own experience would only sing Psalms that are quite kind of happy and avoid the other ones. And so there's a kind of negative overtone of possibly these are sub-Christian, or they're dealing with emotions that Christians should not have, because we love Jesus and Jesus loves us, and that's all that's important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, the girl around the corner, husband, 5 weeks now in intensive care, a young couple just come up from England to settle in Glasgow, never think this would happen to them. And here is a vocabulary which says, this is maybe what it feels like, and here are words that you can use.
Yeah, I loved how you called it a vocabulary for pain.
A vocabulary for pain, yes, and for frustration and for anger. And the thing which, for some people, is the kind of converting thing is when you say, Jesus knew these Psalms. Mm-hmm. Jesus knew all the Psalms. Most of the rabbis of his day would have the Psalms off by heart, by memory. Mm-hmm. And he quotes Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me on the cross? I think that Jesus' spirituality, if one may even dare to think about that, would have been enriched and to some extent modeled as a human being on the Psalms, which are part of his tradition. Mm-hmm. And if these are the things that enabled Jesus, on many occasions, and people tend to think that, you know, the crucifixion, that was the time when he was done to death. There was no other attempts before it. I mean, John's gospel, there's about three occasions when people take up stones or want to stone Jesus. Mm. His first appearance in a synagogue when he's, you know, just starting out on his messianic career in Nazareth, they take him out, haul him out of the synagogue and expect to push him over the mountain on which the town is built. Mm. So he sustains that. And the criticism that he has from the Pharisees, the priests, the thought police. Mm-hmm. These things are what can be offered to God through the saying or the reciting or the singing or the remembering of the Psalms. Mm. Because all that stuff about malicious gossip and persecution, it's all there. Mm-hmm. It's all there. Mm. So I think that if they have been able to sustain Jesus, then are we holier than Jesus that we don't need that kind of vocabulary?
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. How did you become interested in the Psalms? Did you grow up knowing them? Did you grow up singing them?
Well, I think the first song that I remember was "The Lord's My Shepherd," sung to me by my grandmother.
Aww.
I think it was either that or "Oh My Wee Bonnie Boy," which sang it endlessly. But because I'd brought up in a Presbyterian church, you know, we always sang as a second singing. It was a psalm. And yeah, I don't know that that made any kind of great impact on me. I mean, that was the kind of tradition thing which I felt I have to be loyal to. Mm-hmm. It was only later, even in seminary, I don't think that I was particularly attuned to the Psalms. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's more, I've always had an interest in the bits of the Bible that other people kind of turn away from, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's these awful laws about women or mm-hmm. whether it's the battles and people who kill or the discriminatory lines against people for a whole lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, I love these bits of the Bible because they show us where we have been as a human race, mm-hmm. as people who have been grappling to understand God. And the Psalms, to some extent, come into that category because you had all these kind of, you know, cursing other people and complaining to God and asking God where he was. And I think maybe I'd probably be in my 40s or maybe even my 50s mm-hmm. when I began to sit with these and think, well, I can't ignore them any longer. I can read them and then think, well, thank goodness that's not me. Mm-hmm. But there was something, a kind of conjunction about taking these texts seriously because they're in the Bible and I have to find a place for them mm-hmm. within my own faith. Mm-hmm. And also maybe engaging with people who have had just a rubbish lot in life. I mean, I remember very vividly with a group of Roman Catholics from a very poor part of the north of Glasgow and showing them Psalm 88, which is an awful psalm. Mm. And here's this wee woman who says that she never knew that was in the Bible. And if she had known that was in the Bible, she would have read it every Sunday she went to Mass mm-hmm. because she would know, whatever reason, she would never go forward to receive communion for about 3 years. Mm. But that psalm spoke for her. Mm-hmm. And I think having recognized that, and that will be about 15 years ago, that for this woman, who's not, you know, a high-flying intellectual or somebody who's schooled in rabbinic criticism, for that woman, this psalm, which other people would forsake because it's a complaint to God and it asks sarcastic questions and it ends on a very negative note, mm-hmm. that was for her something which affirmed her faith mm-hmm. rather than increased her doubt.
Yeah, and I think in your book, you say that she said, you wouldn't ask those questions if you didn't believe someone was listening. Was that the same woman?
Isn't that the most incredible thing? You wouldn't say, how long, O Lord, will you forsake me? Psalm 13, unless you believe someone was listening. And it's the whole thing about a God who does not offer us the immediate answer which we think we deserve, mm. but who does give us a hearing and enters into a solidarity with our pain. And, you know, the incarnation for me, I just kind of, you know, this Christmas coming up, I always think, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Are we going to have another baby fest? Or are we going to celebrate the incarnation, which is God deciding to take the risk of living as a vulnerable human being, vulnerable to illness, to disrepute, to criticism, to persecution, in order that we might know the solidarity of God, even in our pain, and the desire in the heart of God that things should be different for us. The Psalms just do that. They enable us to know that our pain is inhabited by God, mm-hmm. and that waiting, you know, and being honest about where we are is part of the healing process. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have to sit with the difficulty, mm-hmm. but we never sit alone.
So you see a connection between the Psalms and the incarnation and that God is in solidarity with us in our vulnerability and our pain.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Psalms for the Spirit, a podcast about spirituality and resilience through the lens of the biblical Psalms. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you've listened to these podcasts before, welcome back after a wee break that ended up being a little longer than I'd planned. It's just been a busy few months. So now I'm back, picking up where I left off back in July, and I'm really excited to share the remaining episodes of season 2 with you. Just a few things to let you know about to mark your calendars. If you're inclined to ring in the new year with an online mini retreat from wherever you are, on Sunday, the 2nd of January, 2022, I will be offering another Sing a New Song retreat along with Paul Hutchinson, therapist, mediator, storyteller, and guest from episode 11. The timing for this one will be 7 a.m. in Ireland, 6 p.m. in Australia, and daylight everywhere in between. If that timing works for you, we'd love to see you there. These retreats have been a really meaningful time to look at how music and song can help us through difficult periods and give us inspiration and hope for whatever lies ahead. And for those who were able to be in Ireland on the 25th to 27th of February 2022, I'll be leading a silent retreat at the beautiful Corrymeela Centre on the north coast here. It'll be a chance to still the swirl of everyday life and listen deeply to yourself and to God while in the midst of a gathered community. Information on how to book both of these retreats can be found on my website, kieranyoungwimberly.com. It's by chance that these new episodes are coming out during the season of Advent, but I think it's fitting. At this time of the liturgical year, we recognize our longing for a better world, and we name our hopes for justice and peace to become more fully present here on earth. Those themes are most definitely present in the Psalms, which constantly remind us that God is with us in our broken, vulnerable, and beautiful humanity. Thanks for listening to Psalms for the Spirit, and once again, I'm so glad you're with us. Is there a psalm that meant a lot to you at any given point?
Depends on the day of the week and how I'm feeling. I don't really use the psalms in that way. Mm. There's a sequence in which I read the psalms and I'll change it when it comes to, you know, the new Christian year and first Sunday in Advent. I'll decide which ones I'll read over the course of a year. I tend to have an open mind to three things. Is there something in this psalm which might speak to me in a way I've never heard before? Is there something in me which is articulated in this psalm? Or is this psalm taking me to where someone else is? Mm-hmm. My concern and my prayer for them might be more focused. Mm-hmm. So I tend to look at the psalms in that way. But then there are moments of delight. My Bible's, I could show you, but it's so embarrassing. It's fallen to bits. It's full of ink marks. It's probably, you know, it's probably the thing that's either a defamation of God's holy word. But I see reading the Bible as a kind of dialogue with God. So there's marks and question marks and symbols and all the rest of it. And one of the things which I did about 5 years ago or 6 years ago was to read the Bible from beginning to end, but only the chapters that dealt with women.
Oh, right.
I thought it was time that I, who always have worked with female colleagues, should maybe look at the Bible from that perspective. Huh. And so you go into the Psalms and you find all these images of God, which are female, which nobody would ever think of, you know. As the eyes of the servant watch the hands of her mistress, you have the notion of God knitting us together in our mother's womb. You know, it's a lovely female image. And you have the image halfway through Psalm 23 of the Lord not just being our shepherd, but being the one who sets the table, which in most cultures are the women. Huh. And all these images of mother birds.
Yes.
You know, under the wing. Under the wing's usually the female wing. You know, they're old male eagles away trying to find some prey, and the old mother sitting there with the chickens. Mm-hmm. And you think, why did it take so long? They have seen that.
I know. I love that part of your book. And the final one that I was actually really kind of taken aback and delighted by was midwifery and the idea of deliverance. And I actually hadn't really, you know, I think of deliverance as more like being freed from bondage or something, but actually, and even some of the specific language you've mentioned was more about birth, delivering, you know, delivering new life. And that just really,
I think midwives are among God's most favorite people. I mean, you have Shifra and Pua who defy the Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they're the midwives who enable Moses to come through the waters of birth into life. And then Moses becomes the midwife who takes the people through the Red Sea to the Promised Land. So, you know, if we're made in the image of God, midwifery is a big thing in God's mind. And we sing, "No, bless, guide me, O thou great Jehovah." Deliverance comes into that song. And we never think, it's a movement from one sphere to another, from constriction to liberation to freedom. And that's as much to do with the waters of birth as it was the Red Sea, as it is for people today. God midwifing us into a new reality.
There were so many wonderful parts of your book. I found the discussion of encountering malicious gossip or slander or accusation, or and then your discussion of malediction. It's not a word I say very much.
Benediction, malediction. No, you don't say. No, nobody does. No, we don't.
But it was really fascinating. I think those are among the ones that are more disturbing for some people. Can you say a bit more about those?
Well, first of all, they're in the Bible, so we have to acknowledge their presence. And you have to ask, if someone is being grossly deceitful, if someone is ruining your life by taking money out of your bank or by spreading malicious gossip, what do you wish for the person who's the perpetrator? You know, if you've been the victim of sexual abuse, what do you wish? Do you wish that they don't do it to anybody else, or that if they do, other people just forgive them? I mean, that to me is a denial of the will of God. You know, God does not will that people just sit and take it, but that we find ways of resisting, preferably non-violently. But also that we're able to put into words what we would like to happen to the person who is our oppressor, but we don't take the action necessarily which would lead to their demise. Mm-hmm. So what the Psalms do is they put into the hands of God. The Psalmists, they never say, "Oh God, just give me the knife and the moment and I will terminate this guy's life." Yeah. I mean, that might happen in the history books, mm-hmm. but it doesn't happen in the Psalms. Mm-hmm. And the Psalms said is, "My pain is intolerable. The things that have happened to me are totally unjust. I know who's doing this to me, and I wish that you would destroy them. What they've done to me, let it be done to them." But it's always that God is seen as the agent of potential retribution, mm-hmm. who knows the bigger context. Yeah. We have to express our anger, and we have to say what we desire, but we have to put it in the hands of God. And I think it's because God knows the bigger context. Mm-hmm. You know, I think on the other side of time, when, pray God, we get to heaven and all things are revealed, we might just discover about those who have been so awkward or difficult or vindictive towards us, something of the context in which they lived, mm-hmm. which makes it possible at that time to forgive, but at this time just to will them to be out of our life and out of other people's lives. I mean, behind all this, I just think God wants us to be honest and not nice.
That's the thing. It's about that really deep honesty. And there's something healing about being able to be true to what really is going on and not to act like it's not affecting you. Because if something terrible like that happens to you, you are going to be affected. And you need to be able to take that into the context of prayer somehow. And that this gives us language for it that, you know.
I mean, I remember when my mother was nearing her end, and she had a debilitating illness which had not been diagnosed. It was presumed she had depression, but in the last 16 months, it was realized that it was a physiological illness which was just diminishing her ability to think clearly and to remember things. And it was not a pleasant end. She was a great woman. And I was quite taken by one of my female friends, who was a great friend of my mother's, Now, the pair of them got on like a mother and daughter. You know, Christine had lost her mother and my mother never had a daughter, so they just clicked. And Christine said to us one day, "I am so angry with God about what's happening to your mother." And I remember thinking, well, actually, so am I, but I've been afraid to admit it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's not that you're, it is that you're angry with God that this is happening to a lovely woman, but it's, that's the way you have to express it.
Yeah. So was there something, was there sort of a release or a relief that happened when you were able to express that?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, if we love God, we can say these kind of things or feel these kind of things, because God's understanding of what is behind our pain or our disappointment or our anger is always there in a way which it might not be. We might think that what we're saying or doing is beyond, we don't understand it, but God's got the bigger picture. I think, you know, I suppose it's a regret of mine. In my upbringing, I never saw my mother and father being angry with each other. I mean, they may have been, but neither my brothers or I ever saw them being angry. I think they thought, we don't want to upset the kids.
Yeah.
So when I was, that would be, I think about 21, 22, I think, the first time I was angry with an adult, and I didn't know what to do with it. And afterwards, I felt quite guilty.
And it was
also because, you know, with this notion that anger is not a Christian thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you read the Bible, you know, you see how many people Jesus is angry with. You know, they all get it in the neck. The disciples, the Pharisees, Peter particularly, folk who want to keep women away, folk who want to keep kids away, they all get it in the neck. But it's an anger which is rooted in a sense that there is an injustice here, which has to be resisted.
Yeah.
We can't just let it pass. We have to articulate it. Right. This is an unjust thing.
Yeah.
And anger is a kind of spur or an indication that something has gone wrong. Now, there's a different kind of anger, which is all just animosity and pique and jealousy and all that kind of nonsense. So that's a thing that one has to confess and get rid of it by confession.
Yeah.
But the other kind of anger, I think, we have to feel that we can articulate it without demeaning the people that we're angry with.
Right. Well, it sounds like expressing your anger in prayer is a good way to start to offload some of your anger, whichever kind it is, if it's the kind that just needs to be confessed and then let go of, or if it's the kind of anger that is about injustice that needs to be acted upon.
Yeah.
You do talk about injustice in one of your chapters as well. And I really liked, you said the Psalms nourish. I'll read it. I just found it. The Psalms, because of the particularity of their genesis, demand that we who were nourished by them should put flesh on the bones and ponder exactly where justice is lacking and where injustice abounds, so that we might know whom to pray for and what to resist.
Write that.
Yeah, that was a good line, wasn't it? I just love the idea of putting flesh on the bones, you know, that they nourish us to put flesh on the bones so that we can act.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things in the back of my mind that was that, you know, people sometimes use justice. Put in a prayer, you know, we'll pray for the people who are ill and people who are dying, these people who are bereft, and we'll pray for situations of injustice in the world. Without being specific. No, you can't be specific all the time. But I think that the Psalms always come out of a concrete situation. And it's a matter for me of trying to identify what is the concrete situation today which allows these Psalms to blossom within our experience. And the nice thing is that there's no perfect answer.
And that answer would always be changing depending on what's going on.
Exactly, that answer. And that's one of the great gifts of poetry, of which the Psalms examples. The poetry, it deals with the truth behind the facts. Mm-hmm. It deals with the emotional intelligence as much as knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it allows us to ponder at different times in our life how this text might relate to us or relate to others. Mm-hmm. It moves me, you know, recently I did an evening with people in the Netherlands and asked people to reflect on a kind of difficult psalm. And this woman who was there just spoke of her experience of having lost her husband of only a few years and what happened thereafter. And it just, you know, it incarnated the psalm and the real life. And people who, I don't know her very well, but people who knew her would be able to appreciate just how this particular psalm spoke so poignantly mm-hmm. for her and to her. Mm. And that's, I think that's the job of the church. I mean, we just be singing. I mean, we'll be Presbyterians, I'm one. Da 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 da. That's how we sing the psalms. And it's awful. It's awful. And so we don't ponder them. You know, but these words have been chosen. They've come out of a concrete reality and they're deep. And we have to find ways in which we can ponder them and then find where in the world or our lives or the lives of others they have something to, though they reflect reality.
Mm-hmm. There's a huge transformation that can happen if we see that the Psalms are not supposed to be only about something that relates to us, but they help us to understand other people's situations.
What shall I?
As a hymn writer and as somebody who has, well, you've written psalms to melodies, some folk melodies as well, which I have to say inspired me to work with folk melodies that I was hearing here in Northern Ireland.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I grew up hearing some of your songs, and I think your name was probably one of the first hymn writers' names that I recognized because I would look down to the bottom and say, who wrote this thing? Because I like it. Who's this John Bell character? So I was probably in my teens or something, started to, you know, see your name written. And I think what I have always been drawn to about your songs is that they do kind of, they connect in with the emotion that I think is expressed in the Psalms, whether they are about that or not. Some of them, one that I am thinking of is We Cannot Measure How We Heal. What's the title of that one?
We Cannot Measure How You Heal.
How You Heal. Uh-huh. That's such a beautiful, beautiful hymn that has really come in handy when we need to address those really difficult experiences in life. How did you come to write that? Did it have anything to do with these explorations of the Psalms or?
No, it was before.
Oh,
I mean,
it's
one of the earlier songs which we wrote. Mm-hmm. By that time, I was beginning to think we have to reflect reality. And it happened because on the island of Iona in the abbey there, once a week, there's a service of healing, you know, prayers and laying on of hands. And there were only about two songs that were in the hymn book at that time, which we could use, one of which was just dire. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and I were leading the week, and there were, you know, people there who had come through things that we hadn't come through, you know, the death of a child, domestic abuse. And it was feeling, I think, the experience of these people is not contained in the words of the normal hymns we sing mm-hmm. at a healing service. Mm-hmm. So can we find an expression of some of the things that we've just picked up. Mm-hmm. So that's where it came from. Mm-hmm. In a way, a lot of what you might call pastoral music doesn't come from thinking, oh, I must write a song about this or that. Yeah. But here's a situation, here's a person, and is there anything that we can offer here?
Yeah.
So it's as particular as that. Yeah, mm. It's as particular as that. Mm. And also, you know, we at that time we had no notion that MD would ever sing it again. I mean, it was these things were never, none of our material was ever written for publication. It was written for the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we weren't thinking, oh, we must do a book. No. We've never done that. And we only kind of released it or let it go and be published after we'd kind of tested it with other people, you know, just not in a worship environment, but apart from that, is this a song which speaks of God to you or of you to God?
Mm-hmm.
Because then you know, if you're going to be to write hymns, you have to think not of how I feel. You know, you're not inviting people to look into your soul and admire your spiritual insights. You're enabling people to have the means by which they either in praise or regret or curiosity can relate to God. And therefore the public have a right to judge whether the material is responsible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Psalms are there because people found them useful.
Yeah.
I mean, there are probably a lot more Psalms written. You know, there might have been 1,000 more, but these are the ones which seem to speak to people and therefore they were selected and put into the book.
Mm-hmm. And I love the term that you use, pastoral music. I think that's a really good description of it because it attends to the particular experiences of human life. And it's not about kind of declaring theological insights or doctrine or, you know, but it's about actually tending to the soul and the spirit through music and through words. I love to hear that story about that song because I'd say that moment in which you first used that song was a very powerful one. And then that song has gone on to be used in many other situations where there was a moment, you know, and I can actually think of a moment when we had this song down at the Cree at Corrymeela. And I was so thankful for that song because I felt that it had words that other songs didn't have, you know, that it was tending to something that needed to be tended to.
Well, you know, it might have been a year after it was written. It might have been less, but there was this awful thing in the wee cathedral town of Dunblane where there were a whole lot of kids who were gunned down by a man who went into the school and just opened fire and others were wounded. Mm. And there was a service broadcast, I think, on television the following Sunday in which that song was sung. Now, I don't think they would know where it came from. I think somebody had taken it back from Iona, just the words on a sheet of paper, and somehow it ends up in Dunblane Cathedral. But people who were there said that it was so apt, you know, cradling children and the transition from this life to the next, that it just spoke into that situation in a way which perhaps none others could have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thank God for that, you know, that it found a use and has found a use beyond that which was the original intention.
Mm-hmm. When you share songs like that, do you ever find that people are uncomfortable with the way it touches into those deep emotions, or do you find that people welcome it
Yeah, there's both.
Yeah.
Particularly songs about death. You know, oh, no, I don't want to do that. We can't go there. And it's a fear of their own mortality, mm-hmm. or not owning up to the fact that we die. Sometimes people say, oh, I'd love to have that at a funeral, but I'll just cry. Well, maybe that's what you have to do.
It's an appropriate time to cry.
Aye. I mean, I don't...
Should be, anyway.
I'm not interested in writing tearjerkers, but I am interested in allowing a text to articulate exactly where people are. Mm-hmm. There's one text for the funeral of a baby, we kind of cradle you the way we wanted, mm-hmm. which came out of the experience, not my experience, but of mm-hmm. a young couple whose first baby was, they knew that she would be born severely deformed mm-hmm. and that the rigor of birth would probably end her life. Mm-hmm. And the thing for them was that, you know, they knew that she would die, but what they didn't know was the emptiness of not having a text when they laid their baby on the ground. Oh. So months later, I didn't know this couple, but I met the boy, you know, he asked if he could speak to me. And eventually I recorded all that he'd said. Yeah. I mean, I wrote it down. It was a very vivid thing. I'm not a father, so it's not my thing. Mm-hmm. But I really felt this pain has to be registered and this awkward moment cannot go past without having some kind of resolution. So I wrote this text mm-hmm. and said to them, is this what you'd like to have had said or sung at your mm-hmm. daughter's funeral? And they wrote back and said, yes. And then they asked if it could be put in the book in the hospital where the baby was born for other people who'd been through that. And then later they agreed that it could be made more widely known.
Yeah.
Now, there is a tune to it, but it's more like a solo song than a song that would be sung by a congregation. But people can't sing it because they cry. And that's okay. You know, and it's very difficult. It's even for me. I mean, if I were reading this at a funeral, I'd find it very difficult.
Yeah.
But that kind of experience of losing your baby mm. in the womb or at birth or at an early age, that experience is not something for which holding back your tears is honouring God.
Mm.
I think that experience is one where if tears have to be shed, then the liturgy surrounding the funeral has to enable that
mm.
and not encourage people to be staunch and all that kind of pathetic nonsense which prohibits people from expressing their humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you're talking, I'm thinking about the image of God as midwife, and it's, you know, God is with us in our birth and when life is impossible to be ushered into the world, and
yeah.
There's something very powerful about that.
Yeah, and that's a good image, you know, the midwife is a good image. You're, mm-hmm. you're going from one reality mm-hmm. to the other, from the womb into life, and from life into the life beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a midwifing process there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very glad you said that, if you don't mind me repeating it elsewhere, because I think that is a good image.
Well, it's your image. But just as we're talking about the, you know, the tenderness and fragility of birth, and birth that isn't able to take place for different reasons, and the pain around that, but thinking of God as the midwife through that, you know, ushering us yeah. through that difficult experience. Well, I want to thank you for being a guiding light to so many people, for putting out musical resources that can help people to connect with some of the pains of life. And you've given so many people a vocabulary for pain. Some of your songs have, you know, words from the Psalms themselves, but I think so many of them, they connect in with that same idea of giving us a vocabulary for pain. And I find that really valuable. And it is a great contribution to the sacred music of today. So I want to thank you for all your work. Thank you for being
here. Thank you very much. I mean, well, I can't be anybody else, thank God. But I do on behalf of the whole church, the same way as what you do on behalf of the whole church. So there's a kind of equality in ministry. And some people get a higher public profile than others, but that doesn't make them more important.
Mm. Well, that's very, very humble of you to say.
So God bless you, Karen. It's been lovely, lovely talking to you.
Thank you. God bless you as well. You've been listening to Psalms for the Spirit, produced by myself, Kieran Young-Wimberly, with music by John Bell. On my website, kieranyoungwimberly.com, you'll find links to what I'm up to and opportunities to connect. Till next time, may our spirits find healing and hope in the days ahead.
Come, Spirit, come, rescue us, we pray. Shield us and save us, and come down to stay.